Welcome to the AAK podcast, brought to you by All About Kids, the leading provider of children's therapeutic and educational services in New York. This podcast will dive deep into discussions on children's developmental needs and the stories of parents and other adults who have dealt with developmental disorders. Each conversation on this show is an extension of our mission to create a world where all children have access to intervention, allowing them to live a full and rich life without restriction, where parents have access to the information and training they need to support their child's therapy and special education needs, and where disabilities, therapy, and special education can be openly discussed without stigma. What's going on, everyone? I'm Zach, your host of the All About Kids podcast, and this time I sit down with Sandy Lebbins-Mosher, the ABA program supervisor at All About Kids, to discuss the foundations of ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis. We get into the fundamentals of ABA as a practice, how you can teach parents to be detectives, step-by-step examples of how to diffuse unwanted behaviors of your child in real-world situations, the communication of nonverbal children, visual learning, and more. This is the first part of a multi-part series on ABA, so make sure you're subscribed to the All About Kids podcast so you don't miss an episode. Without further ado, please enjoy part one of the ABA series with Sandy Lebbins-Mosher of All About Kids. Sandy Lebbins-Mosher, thank you for joining me on the All About Kids podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
So I think a good way to start before we dive into ABA would be to explain what it is you do and your background in ABA therapy.
Sure. So I've been in the field for over 25 years now. When I started as a teacher assistant, actually, I was placed in a classroom and they were teaching how to do ABA. This was over 25 years ago. So it was new to that school at the time. And so I learned from the ground up. I, you know, learned as a teacher assistant and then became a teacher and then became a consultant and kind of moved up the ladder that way and, you know, did lots of private work through agencies as well, working with families. I have no idea about how many families I've worked with in total, but each of those children that I've worked with and families have taught me an awful lot, you know, and I continue to learn every day.
So you've been through the ringer of ABA. You've done the private setting, you've done consulting, and you got in when it was first becoming more popular, kind of at the ground floor when people were using it?
Back when I started, the numbers of children on the spectrum were like 1 in 1,000. It wasn't nearly as significant as it is now, like 1 in 54, I think, was the last number. And so it's really, I had no idea what I was getting myself into, literally. It was just a job opportunity. I needed, you know, a job that was flexible with my children. And I fell into it and fell in love with it and became a person that would train staff. You know, I always sort of did ABA a little bit differently than what I was taught because it was taught very like kind of rigidly. And I wasn't fond of that. So I always had like a softer approach and that's how I teach it now and have always taught it to others.
Before we dive into your approach with ABA, for people listening who may not be familiar with ABA or have some sort of general concept in their head, they don't have an in-depth understanding of it. What is ABA, Applied Behavioral Analysis, how you understand it?
Sure. So ABA really is a scientific approach to understanding behaviors. So we use the principles of positive reinforcement. We try to understand and gain an understanding of the function of the behavior through data collection. That's how we make our decision making, you know, what's working, what's not working. And that could be whether we're looking to increase behaviors. So sometimes we're looking to increase those academic skills, right? Those skills in socialization. And sometimes we're looking at decreasing behaviors, so such as tantruming or hitting or whatever. So it's understanding like where it's coming from so that we could appropriately intervene and either increase or decrease depending on what it is.
you mentioned you have a softer approach to ABA, or you started to take a softer approach than what was being used at the time. What do you mean by that?
So how it was taught way back when was a kind of strict chair to chair kinds of, you know, you give the directive like 10 times and we're working with little kids. Like it just seemed that that was a little bit too structured. While they need structure, it was a little bit too much. So I always kind of embedded myself, especially working early intervention, like in their routines of their day, you know, sitting on the floor. If they're playing with blocks, I'm getting down on the floor and I'm playing blocks with them. And with whatever it is, whatever skill I'm trying to teach, I'll embed myself into there. So it's not like, stop what you're doing and having fun. Come over to this table so I can play blocks with you or do something else. Like I try to embed myself more and whatever they're motivated by, you're going to get better results that way. And so I've used that as, you know, I've used myself and the children I've worked with as like little experiments and trying my different ideas, you know, and then I go ahead and teach others to do the same with usually pretty good results.
Yeah, I don't know why education in many ways is so separated from what kids and teenagers are motivated by or what's fun to them, what would be an exciting activity. So right now I'm going through the process of learning French and my teacher was telling me when you learn a language in school, you learn things that you may or may not even use, kind of those textbook things of learning, you know, fire truck or red or colors. And it's not really tied to the topics that you're interested in. And I noticed that I became much more motivated to study French and to do things like make index cards and have conversations with French when I started tying it into the topics that I was interested in the most, like podcasting or things going on in the world or Netflix shows, things like that, listening to them with subtitles. And so what you said made me think about my own experience. And I'm sure the same thing probably applies to ABA. When you can tap into a kid's interest, you'll get a much more involved and a much more motivated pursuit by that child to want to learn.
Absolutely. Motivation is key. If you don't have motivation, you're not going to get very far. The first step when I'm training staff is you have to pair yourself as the biggest reinforcer. So when you walk into a home or into a preschool setting, you want the child running towards you because, wow, this is the person I have fun with. Or we don't want to make ourselves appear that we're that work person, that we're that person that's going to make you sit down and do the stuff you don't want to do. We have to camouflage everything as we're having fun together. And yes, we're learning. You don't realize you're learning, but you know, by making yourself the biggest reinforcer, that's and you know, and build that motivation and use things, as you said, that motivate them. Now you're gonna get somewhere with that child.
Yeah, that's always been the most enjoyable type of learning to me when you don't realize that someone is trying to pump information into your head or trying to create a new
Absolutely.
Habit, but you pick up that new habit or you pick up that new information as a byproduct of doing a fun activity that relates to something you're interested in.
Absolutely. A lot of times, and some providers I feel shy away from using music a lot. And I love music. I try to encourage them to use music a lot. Most of the kids love music. And so we can teach so much through music. We could teach them how to imitate during certain songs, you know, Wheels on the Bus or imitating, you know, if there's ducks going across the screen, you know, you can stop it and ask them what it is. What color is it? What does it say? Let's practice saying the duck sounds. Like there's so much you could do. And they're having fun, right? It's their favorite song. They get to see the animals they love. They don't even realize that they're working, but yet I'm getting my stuff in.
There's so much movement with your body and your mouth and forming words with ABA that it seems like music and
ABA therapy would be a natural pairing where you're moving along to the song or you're imitating something, or like you said, you're forming words with your mouth. That could be a great sort of thing to make a playlist that has songs that that kid likes and use that to teach them to, you know, move and sound out words in different ways.
Absolutely. And music and being able to imitate sounds, they're connected. You know, sometimes I have kids bounce on a ball before we even start therapy. They just think they're bouncing on a ball and having fun. We might be working on ready, set, go, you know, having them say that. But I find over and over again, their ability to imitate sounds increases after they get that movement. So movement and music, all of that is crucial.
Those kids are going to be ready to go for their first music festival, whenever that is, when they're older. Lollapalooza, Ultra down in Miami, they've been doing it for years already.
Yeah.
So you mentioned when we had a back and forth before the podcast, you mentioned that a lot of the work that you've done is to teach parents how to be detectives with their own kid and how to be detectives with the way their kid's behaving or saying certain things. What do you mean by that with parents being detectives?
So when I'm working with families, it's important to get them engaged and to teach them as much as possible because, you know, I'm in their lives an hour a day or whatever it is, and they have their child the whole rest of the time and for the rest of their life. I'm not always going to be there. And so it's important for me to teach them these skills that they need so they can practice with their children, you know, and their child can continue to make gains. The child's best outcomes will come if we're both working on similar things. So what I teach them is, I teach them one, that behavior is communication. So your child may not be able to communicate verbally with you at the moment, but they still know what they want. They still know what they don't want. They still, you know, they have no means to communicate that to you. And sometimes it comes out as behavior. So I teach them to look at, you know, what do you think they're trying to communicate to you as they're, you know, screaming on the floor? You know, what did they want something? Did they not want something? Do they want your attention? You know, teaching them the functions of behavior. There are four functions to behavior and trying to help them learn how to analyze the behavior. And then by knowing where it's coming from or the why behind it, it helps us know how to intervene properly.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of behavioral issues and outbursts and outrage, even with adults, stems from a lack of communication. And even with two adults that have great command of the English language and they're talking to each other and they're saying what they think is an accurate depiction, or they're receiving what they think the other person said. A lot of times I've noticed we all tell stories in our head rather than listen to what the other person is saying. We kind of put it through our own filter. So I'd imagine if you're a kid and you may not even have the words or vocabulary or be able to frame what you want and desire in a way that can be understood by adults, that can be very frustrating. And then the adult may not have a filter or a framework to be able to take those movements or sounds and accurately guess what that means or what they want.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes the family or the classroom teacher, when I'm working in preschools, they just see the behavior. They just see Johnny flopping around on the floor crying, and they're not really looking at why he may be crying. Did somebody take his toy away? Is he hungry? Does he have a bellyache? Like, these are literally all the things when I would get called into a classroom because there was behavior issue. I'm asking them like 50 questions before, because it's not just what you see. There's more behind it. And we have to learn what happened before the behavior started so we can properly intervene.
Yeah. And speaking of behavior, you sent me a great example of a kid at the supermarket wanting candy, which is very timely because Halloween just passed. So this episode will be coming out in the aftermath of the post-Halloween celebration. Would you be able to walk me through that example of the kid at the supermarket and how the parents could get involved to make it beneficial for both people?
Sure. I mean, it's not just Halloween. Honestly, moms and dads, when they do food shopping, have this struggle all the time because where does the store put the candy? By the checkout aisle,
oh, yeah.
Right?
Dude, they're geniuses. They know exactly.
Oh, yeah.
They know exactly where to put those things that you see at the last second, right before you check out. There's so much money that goes into buyer psychology.
Yes. And they, you know, it works. It's there because it works, right? Mm-hmm. Behavior happens. If it gets reinforced, it's working for them. It continues to happen. Same thing. So these poor families have this struggle of, you know, going food shopping, finally making it through everything, going to checkout, and there's the candy aisle. So now Johnny's flipping out because he wants his, whatever, Snickers bar. And mom's just like done all this food shopping and just wants to get out. So she'll buy him the Snickers, even though he's hysterical, because that's the way he's communicating that he wants it. Because he's, in this case, not able to communicate, "Mom, I want a candy bar." And, you know, there can't be that back and forth communication. So, you know, so what we've taught Johnny by buying him that Snickers is, this is how you ask for a candy bar. I wait until all the shopping's done. I see the candy bar. I start screaming and crying and I get a candy bar. So if it's working, it will continue to happen, right? So he's going to do it the next time and the next time.
Especially as a kid, if you get rewarded for throwing a tantrum or having an outburst, the only connection that you make, and I remember making this connection as a kid, is when I do that and I get something, that means the next time I act this way, I'm going to get the same exact thing. And it's building those connections in my brain where I think, oh, I want to eat dessert before dinner. I screamed, my mom gave me dessert. Therefore, whenever I want dessert, I'm just going to scream. And so it's like, and I'm sure every parent has dealt with that, but that's one example of where the actual outburst in real time almost gets like medicated by the, like you're addressing the symptoms rather than the root of the problem, which is that there's a child communicating something he or she wants. And rather than look into that and rather than ask yourself the question of, can I do something about this? Can I tackle the root of the problem? It's like you're dampening it for the next 30, 45 minutes until a similar problem pops up again.
Exactly. And it will, because that's what we've taught them to do, right? By doing that, by reinforcing that. And so, yeah, so it's easier. You can understand, you know, the parents just want to get out there. It's embarrassing when your kid's, you know, crying and screaming and people are looking at you. And some people will even comment and make negative comments, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could understand that in that moment, that's the quick fix. Let's just buy him the Snickers and let's just be on our way and we don't have to deal with it. But what happens is every time now, this is going to be a problem. So we need to do something about it, right? Because who wants that stress? Sometimes families will resort to leaving the child home or, you know, or changing things up that way because they can't deal with the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So then I would just teach them to help them understand how they're reinforcing the behavior and encourage them that next time they go, that they can't buy, if he's crying and screaming, that, you know, then candy can't be bought at that time. And the behavior might actually increase because they're going to try and really take it up a notch, a few notches, so that, you know, well, it worked last time and the time before, like, why isn't it working now? And what do I have to do to get it to work? So sometimes they'll escalate, maybe start hitting or biting or something. Then the parent will buy the candy bar. So now they're like, oh, so now I no longer just have to cry. Now I have to cry and scream and kick and hit and bite. And then I get my candy bar. So it's really, it's accidental, but it's really, becomes a bigger problem. So if we are consistent in just holding back that and not buying it for him, eventually he will realize that he's not going to get the candy bar. On the other side of that is also teaching them to be proactive. if we do all of our shopping nice and quiet, here, you could play with this toy maybe while we're shopping. Then you could have the candy bar in the car, but not if you're kicking and screaming at the, you know, so you could also have that proactive strategy, which I try to teach a lot of families. You know, it's better to be proactive to try and avoid a behavior.
Okay, so like teaching a child to delay gratification, that if you stop crying now, you will get rewarded 30 minutes or an hour from now, something like that, in a different location.
So we have to be careful with the whole bribery thing. Reinforcement mm-hmm. and bribery are kind of similar but different. So when we want to reinforce, we want to offer the reinforcement before the behavior is even thought about. So that's why you want to be proactive, right? So prep him before the store, you know, right outside the store. Remember, if we get through the whole shopping and there's no kicking and screaming, you can have your candy bar. So we're being proactive and reinforcing them, as opposed to once the behavior begins and now you're offering something, that becomes more bribery. And we don't want that.
That's a good defense for someone who's involved, like a police officer that took a bribe. And his defense would be, no, the mention of the reward came up before the action. So technically I was reinforced. I wasn't bribed. And the judge would have to agree with him. I feel like that's a great point. But yeah, no, sir, that's a good distinction between, like you said, prepping your child to anticipate that desire for seeing something like a candy bar and having that child integrate that into their trip to the supermarket and them realizing that on their own, rather than you having to kind of hit back at them with the, you know, stop crying and you'll get this in the car. If a kid knows before that, he can almost, you know, maybe self-soothe a little bit or learn to just sit there and do something else for a little bit, which I think is a great skill, even as an adult. Something that I need to work on more is just learning to sit around, and it's okay to not get what you want for 20 or 30 minutes if you're standing in line or waiting for something, whatever it is, to have some patience and know that eventually you'll be rewarded for it.
I also teach them to, you know, most of these kids are very young, right? I've worked a lot in early intervention and preschool. And so, and then with developmental delays, then they're actually younger, you know, developmentally than the chronological age. And so there's all these factors. So I give the families different strategies, like maybe making a shopping list and getting them engaged in the shopping. So they're looking for, oh, we need apples. Let's find apples. It's a good way to also reinforce colors and identifying things so they could be learning as they're shopping as well, and getting them more engaged in the process also. So that, you know, because little kids really can't be expected to like just sit and wait, really. Their attention spans are too short. So I try to get them engaged as much as possible throughout the process and make quick trips to the supermarket at first when you're working on all of this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Get in those shorter reps first. So if you're an adult in this situation, the classic supermarket outburst, is there a specific type of language or a certain order that is better than other type of language when talking to your child? Like, should you acknowledge how they're feeling first and say, I understand you're feeling this way, and you know, this is what's going to happen? Or what are some examples of specific language or specific actions that you would tell a parent in one of those situations?
Sure. So once a behavior has started, then that's really not the time to really be speaking to them and kind of talking them out of the behavior. You would give them the directive of what was expected in that moment. So if they, let's say they flop to the floor, if they need them to stand up and walk, that would be the directive. But when a behavior starts, you want to really limit all that attention you're giving them, all that verbalization, the direct eye contact. Because we want to be, again, proactive in the attention. And when they're doing the right thing, that's when we want to, you know, be you know, giving them positive praise and lots of communication and eye contact. And then so they can see the difference in your body language as well and what they're getting. They may not understand what you're saying. We never know how much kids are actually understanding if they're not able to communicate to us, right? And acknowledge what we just said. And so we want to limit all that because we're not sure. And it's just picture yourself when you're really super angry, like you're not really even hearing what's going on around you, right? You're just in your own brain, kind of like milling about with your anger. And so it's,
yeah, you're seeing red. There's
exactly,
doesn't matter. You could be talking to the most rational person on the planet. And Socrates could literally be in front of me telling me I'm behaving irrationally right now. And if I'm angry, I'm not going to care at all, because I'm, especially as a kid, you get filled with that emotion so much where it's hard to see anything else outside of that. And in a way, it does feel good to get angry. And sometimes you just, you keep feeding into that anger and you take it out verbally or physically. And it's very hard to listen properly and take in any information until that anger subsides a little bit.
Yeah, it's not even conscious. I don't think you can help it, you know? And so it's the same for them. If they're in a full-blown tantrum, they're really not going to be processing the information that you're trying to give them. So you really want to limit your verbalizations without, you know, of course, give them the one directive that you need them, and then just stop, and then just, you know, maybe use a gesture if you want them to come here or sit down or something like that, and just kind of wait them out until they're calmer.
I've seen some work by a woman and neuroscientist named Annika Harris about children's meditation. And it sounds like something that wouldn't work, because I couldn't imagine sitting in the same spot and paying attention to my thoughts and my emotions for more than 2 minutes at a time, especially when I'm 7 years old. And I started meditating much later in life, but I saw some of the work that she was doing, and it seemed like she was having success at shortening the life of emotions beyond their usefulness. So it's like she's not teaching kids to not be angry. It's to recognize that anger and that have it subside as soon as possible, or whenever it's not useful anymore. So maybe that could be something combined with ABA therapy in the future, where you're having a child feel the physical attributes of what it feels like to be angry, and then by recognizing it, it dissipates a little bit.
Yeah. So what I teach kids a lot too is to take 3 deep breaths when they're angry. And well, you have to teach it when they're not angry, because once they're angry, nothing's happening, right? But before, there are, you know, a lot of kids on the spectrum, and quite frankly, a lot of all of us are visual learners. And so a picture speaks 1,000 words. And so for that reason, scripted stories are sometimes helpful. There's a scripted story about Tucker the Turtle, and he gets angry and his friends don't like it. And, you know, he takes 3 deep breaths to decompress. And I would use this scripted story with the children I work with, and depending on their level of ability, it would be interactive, and we would take deep breaths together. And so they would learn that process again when they're not angry, so that when they did get angry, I would remind, what would Tucker do now? You know, let's take our deep breaths. And you would see them, like, they would so angry and so upset, but they're really trying to take that deep breath with you. And then you would model it with them just to, you know, help them do that. And it's a skill that really you could see them decompress, as even though they're not taking like efficient deep breaths in and out at first, it really does help decompress them in that moment. And sometimes when they've learned it really well, sometimes they would come up to me like, I need to take some 3, you know, deep breaths right now. I'm like, okay, let's do it.
I feel that. Is there a reason behind why most kids on the spectrum are visual learners predominantly? Do we know why that is, or it's something we observed and we don't really have a reason for it?
I don't know the exact reason. I know most of us in general are visual learners. I once was training in 4 different schools, the same training, and I posed that question. I just wanted to get a feel for the different schools, the audience in the different schools, on who is a visual learner, who is a, you know, an auditory learner. And I don't think anybody was an auditory learner. Almost everybody was a visual learner. I mean, it's we're predominantly visual. I know myself, I have to write things down. You know, when in preparing for this podcast, you saw I had to type things out. Like, it's just how my brain processes. And I don't know if it's a factor that sometimes their language isn't, you know, functional, that just the picture makes it more understandable for them. But the use of visuals in helping in transitioning and even requesting for some children who don't have a lot of language, they could be taught to request via a picture, or nowadays with all the devices, you know, and apps available, there's also that making visual schedules of their day. Sometimes they have a hard time, you know, with morning routine or toothbrushing or hand washing or whatever it is, or what's going on in the classroom. You know, kids on the spectrum really like sameness and order, and they can be a little rigid sometimes. And so, you know, that brings them comfort. Knowing what to expect brings them comfort. When they don't know what to expect, it makes them very anxious. And that's where sometimes we'll see some behaviors too. So if we could support them by creating a visual schedule, so, okay, now we're, you know, we're going to get ready for school, then we're going to have breakfast, then we're going to go on the bus or whatever the schedule is, then they can actually see and feel like comfort. You know, when I was in a classroom, some kids would go to the visual schedule in the classroom and just reference it for themselves. And I would see them just looking at it to see for themselves, like, okay, we're almost finished with this, and then this is coming. Or some of them would get super excited to see we were almost at the end of the day, you know, and they could go see mommy again. It's very helpful.
Yeah, it's much easier to have a sense of order visually than it is auditorially, because if something's in order over audio, you don't have as much of a dimensional grasp other than listening to how someone sounds or how a sound is. It's kind of sitting on that one dimensional line of, does this sound good or does this sound bad? But when you see things, there's a much more obvious order to things that you can grasp all at once. When you're listening to something, you have to wait until the next thing, but there's nothing stopping you from seeing more and more things. So even right now, I'm looking at some of the things I bought for a home gym, and there's weights stacked up and some of them aren't perfectly straight. And then there's things next to that. It's just one quick glance makes things super apparent to what's in line, what's not in line, corners and things like that.
And also remembering, how often do you meet somebody and their name just goes in one ear and out the other, right? I can't remember any name. I don't know. I'm so bad at like remembering things. And so when you're given information auditorily, sometimes you can't retain it. But if you have a picture there that's a reminder, you may forget it, but you know where to reference it.
That's when you use the friend introduction trick, when you forget someone's name and then you grab someone next to you and introduce them and hope they say their name.
Yep. I try to tell myself all the time, like, really pay attention to the name. And like 5 seconds later, it's out of my brain. I don't even know why.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I don't know. Even times where I repeat it in my head after, I can't remember it. Something that has worked though is tying it to a story, kind of what you talked about a little bit with taking deep breaths, is imagining what this person would do. Sometimes I'll hear someone's name and it'll say it's Ted. And then I'll think, okay, Ted likes turtles. And then that makes me remember their name. But if I just say Ted, 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 Ted in my head, I forget it 30 seconds later. But then I see Ted, I see that guy, I think of turtles, and then Ted pops into my head. I'm like, oh, hi, what's up? Hi, right. Turtles. Right. Except remember not to call them turtles.
You call them the wrong. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So something that I wanted to end on is how does the setting affect the situation? How does setting affect behavior? Things like temperature, you know, amount of people in a room, a kid being super hungry or things like that. Like how do all those things come into play when you're attempting to influence a child or show them to act a certain way? Because that kid is 30 different people throughout the day. Like it literally, your consciousness is going through so many phases of, I'm a little tired when I wake up, I'm starving, I need breakfast. Okay, now I'm full, I'm a little bit sleepy. All right, now I'm awake again. Like how do you navigate the different moods that a child experiences in the different environments throughout the day and align that with the behavior or the exercises that you're trying to get them to do?
It's also what I work with families to look at as well, because whatever happens before the behavior started is crucial, and setting events is part of that. So where are you? Is it more crowded than normal? Is that why some families can't take their kids to a mall or a crowded shop because they'll scream? And it could be a function of that. It's just they're overstimulated by everything. You know, if children are not, if their sensory systems are not working efficiently like ours does, right? We could block out the noise, the light, the sound outside, the dog barking. But if our sensory systems weren't working efficiently, then it would all be at 100% just bombarding us. Mm. And it would be overwhelming. And then their flight or flight gets activated and they just want out of there. So it's something they can't help. And it's something we have to look at. Is that a possibility? Is that why they're crying? Are they too hot? Are they hungry? You know, so we have to look at all those aspects. Are they sick? Is a huge, you know, thing that you should look at first. You know, if somebody who doesn't usually hit themselves is hitting their ear or touching their, or rubbing their ear, like maybe they have an earache, you know, so you want to rule out any medical issues or any medical things that could pop up first, because then that's a whole different way of handling a behavior, right? If they have an earache, no positive reinforcement is going to help that. You need a doctor. Mm. You need to get that treated. You know, yeah. If they're hungry, you know, I had students that would come in and be really cranky and, you know, sometimes throughout the day at a specific time of day become cranky. And when you look at the patterns of it, it was, and then I found out that he wasn't having breakfast in the morning. So he was probably hungry. And then he probably got hungry again at a certain time before lunch, because it was always before lunch. So what we did, you know, you look at those setting events, like what can I change to improve that behavior? Mm. So as soon as he came in, I nonchalantly just offered him some food if he wanted it, not to single him out. So I just kind of offered everybody, you know, kind of food. So he would have something to eat. He wouldn't be hungry anymore. His mood improved. And then again, looking at the time before lunch, oh, he might get hungry again. Let's do a little snack time or something. And so by just observing to see what a setting event could be, and by manipulating and doing something different, it could affect the outcome. And then, so then he was a happy camper throughout the day, because the bottom line was the poor kid was hungry.
Yeah.
And so that kind of rectified everything.
And as a parent, would you keep some sort of log or journal to remember what your kid was doing, or maybe how they were feeling before a certain behavior, a certain outburst? Like if the past three times they started, you know, screaming uncontrollably in the house, it was after 6 o'clock, but before dinner, something like that. Do you encourage parents to keep note logs, things like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, ABA is very, very data driven. So I definitely encourage, I mean, they may not be taking it on a formal data sheet, but however they keep it, doesn't matter. As long as sometimes the time of day is an indicator, or even the person they're with, you know, maybe they only scream when Aunt Jane is around or something, you know, or in school, a certain teacher assistant or something. you can pick up patterns of behavior, you know, through the data. And that's why it's important always to be analyzing the data that you have, because that it tells you where you need to go.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Sandy, so much for coming on the All About Kids podcast and sharing your ABA expertise. You're certainly someone to look to with these topics, and you've had almost 3 decades of experience. So thank you again for hopping on the podcast. And for those of you listening, Sandy shared with me some great resources, which I'll link to the podcast, and we'll also have show notes as well that you can look through. So definitely check those out.
All right. Well, thank you, Zach, for having me. I'm glad I survived.
Oh yeah. We're both still alive. We're alive and kicking. All right, Sandy, I'll talk to you next time.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the AAK podcast. To keep up with all things AAK, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at AAK Cares. For any questions or comments about the podcast, you can reach out to me through my email, which is linked in the podcast description. We appreciate you tuning in. Until next time.